Okay, good. So, hi everybody. Thanks for inviting me. That's my title. That's what I'm going to talk about. And it's going to be a surprise talk because it's going to be my first Blackboard talk in a long time. This is fake. So the talk will follow a handout, except I just last night decided not to follow it. So, I mean, it's still there, and some of it is still relevant, so I'll show you the relevant parts, namely, it's with Roland van der Veen, who is sitting over there. There is a URL, and I'm taping my talks, and I hope to tape all other talks that people will allow me to tape. I mean, I cannot tape people who don't want to be taped. And all of them will appear on that website eventually, hopefully very, very soon. Next, I have to warn you, first of all, that this is a work in progress. That's the WIP, and very much in progress, namely, you know, things are changing almost daily, and I just came from a week visiting Roland in Leiden, and things changed during that week. And that's part of the reason why the handout I prepared sucks. So, because basically it's not yet stable, but it also means that it will be hard for you to follow. You'll have to accept certain things, or accept the imperfection. I usually prefer when I talk about things that they will be totally polished, but they're not. Okay, there is some beauty behind. Okay, but it's not yet polished. And the second warning is the brute warning. So I tend to be a brute. Things are done on the computer. I don't care if they're done on the computer. I mean, sort of, I suppose it's the same warning. I mean, elegance is still missing. Okay, the actual handout is only like the first two pages. The actual content is only in the first two pages. The rest is, or in fact, that's the first two pages are today, the second two pages are what was meant to be my second talk, but I think I've blurred the difference when I decided to switch to Blackboard. But then the rest is just proof that we're serious. So, I mean, it will appear, given the quality of the presentation, it will appear to you as if we're completely flaky, we're just making up things. So I just want to guarantee to you, we're not making up things. I mean, it's in some sense, it's over concrete. It's been turned into programs. It's the middle ground that's right now missing. So the big picture I understand, the programs I understand, and I still don't know how to explain it to humans. Okay? But the fact that there are programs that work, I mean, this is actual code and it's all on your handout, means that it's not, it's there. It really is there. And you know, in particular, you type in the trefoil and you get the output for the trefoil. I mean, and in fact, the next thing is a table which contains sort of similar computations for all knots within in great detail. Okay? And maybe the last things that I want to show from the handout before moving on to blackboards, to the blackboard, is here's a partial to-do list, and I think I counted 19 items on it. But I actually only sort of did it by like that, so maybe it's 19 plus minus 1, probably. Okay? And what? Oh, anyway. 17? I really can't count. Oh my god. Okay. So, but this basically means that there is a lot left to do. You know, I can count here 17 PhD thesi, or what's the plural of thesis? Anyway. I don't know, whatever. I can count here a lot of work, a lot of stuff I mean, partially only I can do it, but partially definitely I cannot do it. Okay? So there is a lot to do. And we can start the talk. So, you know, the main theorem is that everything that matters in the quantum SL2 portfolio can be continuously, in some sense, expressed in terms of docile perturbed, oh my god, I can't spell perturbed, Gaussians using solvable approximation. And the real point is to tell you what do all of these things mean. Okay? Let me start in a different way than what the handout was going to say. So there are blackboards, but these are chalk.
Yeah.
That's the left. Not the left. Oh, wow. Lots of chalk.
So the light.
So is the blackboard visible for everybody? I hope so. So, you know, here's a knot. It's the only knot I know how to draw without assistance from a computer. Now, sort of, it's the end result. It's the dessert. Okay? It's the candy. But sort of, good knot theorists know that it's not only the candies we care about, but the whole portfolio of things that lead to them, the whole pieces and ingredients that make it. Let me try to tell you what are these pieces. So first of all, really what we care about is what you get when you cut a piece of the knot out. So this piece, for example, is a single crossing, but I could cut out bigger pieces. So that single crossing is often called R. God knows why R. Okay? So that's an ingredient, a piece of a knot. In fact, sort of, it turns out that we also care about the minimas and the maximas, or so-called the cups and the caps, or so-called the quaps taken together. So, like, if you cut a piece here, then this is a quap. So this is an up quap, and there is also a down quap down here. Okay? And, in fact, you know, this knot was made by assembling several of these pieces together. So, you know, the pieces originally were cut even further, but then you stitched them together. So somewhere here, you've performed a stitch. I will denote the stitch, the operation of stitching two pieces of a knot together. So like, you know, by now it's a bit cut, the knots that I started from. So to get the trefoil back again, I'll have to stitch here, and stitch here, and stitch here, and here, and here. Okay, so the knot is made by many stitches of the basic ingredients. But I will denote this operation of stitching by M-I-J-K. And it stands for stitching piece I to piece J, strand I to strand J, calling the end result after the stitch K. Okay? But there are other things that you might do. So you may, for example, double a piece of the knot. So you may take a piece, or, you know, given a, maybe I should say, if a knot is cut and it has some loose ends, the result is called a tangle. So given a tangle, you may want to double some of its components. Okay? So this operation is called this operation of taking one component and making two parallel copies of it, is called the doubling operation, or delta I j k, and it stands for taking strand I and making two copies denoted j and k. Okay? And in fact, there is more. So, you know, I failed to tell you that I wanted all the pieces to be oriented. But then, one of the pieces might be oriented incorrectly. You might want to have an operation that flips the orientation of a piece. So, yes, there is another operation. It's called S, and maybe it should have a subscript, SI, which tells you which piece you flip. Okay? So, when I care about knot theory, I don't care just about the operations, just about the objects. I care about the whole portfolio of operations and objects. Okay?
So, what are the indices in this delta thing?
So, you start from a strand labeled I, and you double it and call the daughter strands J and K.
Right from left to right?
Yeah, with some convention that the left component is called J and the right component is called I. And left and right is relative to the orientation of the knot. Okay? So by the way, I kind of made a false dichotomy here. I said that there are objects, the objects being the crossing and the quap, and then there are operations, and the operations are the doubling operation and the reversal operation and the stitching operation, and maybe there are a couple of lesser operations like inserting an identity or deleting an empty strand, deleting a strand. I mean, but these are the primary operations, okay? But the false dichotomy is the dichotomy between operations and objects, because you see, objects can be thought of as operations. They are so-called nullary operations. They are operations. So an operation typically takes an input and produces an output. A nullary operation is an operation that takes no input and produces an output. So this is compared with unary and binary and trinary. Nullary means takes no input, produces an output. That's just an object. Okay? So really I have a big collection of operations here. The operations that has no input and produces a crossing. The operations that has no inputs and produces a quap. The operations that has one strand as an input and produces a double of it, and so on. Okay? Now,
do you have also the operation which takes two parallel strands and makes only one? Or kind of reverse of delta? Or?
Reverse of delta. No, that doesn't make sense topologically. If you have two strands, how can you tell if they are parallel? So, if you have one strand, you can easily double it.
Suppose that the parallel constants will frame.
But then that's not an operation. It's defined on a subset of the thing. It's defined on subject to conditions. It has an infinite definition. Yeah. Okay. So I want to say a bit more things about this portfolio. So first of all, I'm still in the sketch level, and probably I will stay in the sketch level because I'm not sure I'm capable of more. But anyway, formally speaking, I mean, I can give formal definition to all of these objects, and perhaps Roland will in one of his talks. Namely, really what we're talking about here is, well, I said the word tangles before, but to be more precise, these are tangles in which the ins and the ans, outs don't look like a category. They don't need to be at the top and at the bottom. So it's a slightly different collection of tangles. And on the other hand, we do care about rotation numbers. That's what the quaps do. So it's what we call rotational tangles, or even more fully, rotational virtual tangles. So all of these. So if you want to formalize all of this portfolio, you have to talk about something called rotational virtual tangles, and hopefully Roland will say something about it. The second point is, so what is this algebraic structure that appears here? So, you know, I've named the operations, the stitching, the antipode, the coproduct, and the precise algebraic structure that appears here is something called a meta-Hopf algebra. It's not quite a Hopf algebra. I mean, the silly reason is that there is no addition in the business. But the more serious, right, it's not a linear structure. But the more serious issue is that the operations here are actually, contrary to what I said, I called them, I called the stitching operation binary, but it's actually a unary operation. It takes a single strand that has two components, I and J, and stitches these two components. But the input is the single tangle, sorry, not a single strand, a single tangle with two strands, I and J, and stitches these two. So it's actually a unary operation, not a binary operation. So a meta-Hopf algebra is the formal name for this structure. And again, at some point I may say more about it. At the moment, it doesn't matter. Just think about something that has these operations in it. Okay, now why do I care? So I care for two reasons. So one is sort of obvious. Quite clearly, tangle theory is finitely presented with these operations. Namely, the generators are the R's, and I suppose also the C's. Sorry, a quap is often denoted a C. So the generators are the R's and the C's. And clearly, with appropriate usage of M's, you can stitch them up to make anything you want. So that's why it's finitely generated. And the relations are also clearly understood, essentially the Riedemeister relations, plus some more relations to manage the quaps. Okay? But this means that if you want to construct invariants of such things, all you need to do is to specify the value of the invariant on the R and on the C, and then to specify how the invariant changes under a stitching operation. And you get extra points if you figure out how it changes under doubling operations or antipodes. Okay? So if you want to construct invariants, it appears like light work. You don't have to look at the knot as a whole, you just need to look at the generators. Okay? And then the last point why it matters, it is a bit delicate, and this I might show later, explain in detail later. The point is that there is actually very little that you can do with knots in themselves other than telling them apart. Okay? But there are a few properties of knots that in order to define these properties, you need to say something about surfaces in R3 and other gadgets. So, for example, there is the genus of a knot, which is the minimal genus of a surface embedded in R3 whose boundary is the knot. There is a notion of ribbon knots. So these are knots that can be drawn with some singularities allowed and with some other singularities not allowed. An example is down here in on the handout, along with the singularities that are allowed and the singularities that are not allowed. So it turns out that the genus and the ribbon property both can be defined using these operations. So basically, in the language which includes these operations, the genus and the ribbon property and a couple of other lesser properties are definable. Okay, which means that a priori, if you construct an invariant, which is an invariant of the or which is compatible with the whole portfolio, then it a priori has a chance of saying something about genus and ribbon, about the genus property and the ribbon property. And again, I'm here, I'm saying it in a very, very vague way, but there is concrete mathematics behind it as well. Okay? So I can write specific formulas, I can give specific examples, I can tell you what all of this means for the Alexander polynomial. I mean, I'm still at the vague level. Okay? Okay. Any questions or comments so far? Yeah.
So the fact that the genus and the ribbonness can be obtained from the species?
Yeah.
Is this difficult?
It's about two boxes on the handout. And I will, if I get the chance, I'll go through these boxes. And, you know, if you'll push me, if you'll ask me, draw, please say it now, I will say it. Okay? I don't know if I, but on the other, so I should go back to it, perhaps. But I think I want to sort of, first of all, give the full sketch. Okay, so now I'm in point number two. What matters and why, but I didn't yet tell you the what is the object that I'm really studying. Okay? I'm only told you what it relates to in topology. Yes.
Right, you're speaking about virtual tangents.
Sorry?
Yeah, in reality speaking about virtual tangents. Is that true?
Everything in quantum topology is about virtual knots, even if you pretend that it isn't. Sorry, everything in quantum knot theory is about virtual knots, even if you pretend that it isn't.
And how does this even know whether it's a knot?
That's the point. Quantum topology does not know if what you're holding is a knot or a virtual knot. It cannot know.
But then what do you mean by genus?
So it turns out that there is a definition of genus for virtual knots, which totally makes sense. Basically what I said, the genus can be defined in these terms, and therefore it also means has a meaning for virtual knots. It's a little more subtle than that, but again, I think I prefer to continue with the sketch.
I would really like you to go back to this at some point.
Okay, good. Pressure me. You know, we have a week, right? Pressure me and pressure all London. Okay. So I want invariants compatible with this portfolio. And fortunately, there is a machine that produces them, and it's the quantum group portfolio. Or you choose a quantum group, and it's the portfolio of things that are associated to it. So I want to explain what it is. So if you have a quantum group, so a quantum group is U, Q, G. This should look mysterious, okay? To some people at least, and totally boring to others. Gregor, totally boring, right? And other people, mysterious. So, first of all, what are these things? So, G is some classically algebra. I mean, for much of what we will do, it is SL2, but it can be, or a cousin of SL2. But in principle, it's a one of the standardly algebras. If it wasn't for the Q here, then you would be talking about the universal enveloping algebra of that Lie algebra. This should be mysterious to some people still. Should I say something about it? So what's a Lie algebra? So I'll just say it in a couple words. So a Lie algebra is a vector space along with a bracket operation. So for any two elements, you can say what is the bracket. And the bracket, so for example, if you're talking about the Heisenberg algebra, then it's the vector space generated by three elements, subject to, so T, X, and Y, subject to the bracket of X and Y is equal to T, or maybe it's negative T, I'm not sure. And and subject to the fact that the bracket of T with anything else is equal to zero. So the bracket of T with X is equal to the bracket of T with Y is equal to zero. So the Lie algebra is the vector space generated by this. So it's three-dimensional. The Lie algebra is three-dimensional. And there are some operations. There is a bracket operation on it. The universal enveloping algebra of this Lie algebra is an infinite-dimensional gadget. It's essentially the set of all words you can write using these letters. So it's words like, and then you allow linear combinations of these words. So it's words like x, y, x, x, t, t, y, and you know, all other such words, finite words, but with unbounded length. So all such words. Modulo, a single relation. And the relation is that the bracket of any two letters, bracket in the sense of the Lie algebra, is equal to the product given one way minus the product given written in the other way. So this makes the universal enveloping algebra way smaller. Because, for example, here I have xy. If I really wanted, I could rewrite it as y times x. So I could replace ab by b times a. And the cost is ab. So if I flip these two, the cost will be a factor of t. But now, the t appears in the total left. But the t commutes with everything else, so I can bring it to the right if I wanted. And in a similar way, I could sort the letters so that all the y's will appear in the left, and all the x's will appear in the middle, and all the t's will appear in the on the right. Now, this sorting, when you sort, you pay a price. So every time you flip two letters, you create a new term with the commutator of the two. But the price has fewer letters, right? If you flip a two-letter word into another two-letter word, the price is something which is just a single letter. So the process terminates. And the axioms of the Lie algebra are such that the process terminates uniquely. Okay? So basically, this is also equal to the set of all words of the form y to the power m, sorry, linear combinations of words of the form y to the power m, x to the power n, t to the power p. Okay? And this in itself is simply like polynomials in x, y, and p. So a universal enveloping algebra is also always an algebra of polynomials, except with the product is not the product of polynomials. Because if you take two such yxt's and put them next to each other, in order to bring them back to the yxt form, you have to do lots of shuffling of things and pay lots of prices, and so the product is complicated. Okay? But I mean, other than, so at least as a vector space, the universal enveloping algebra is isomorphic to the so-called symmetric algebra of G, the algebra of polynomials in the letters of, in the basis of G. Okay? So that was a very, very quick introduction to the universal enveloping algebra. And UQG is the quantization. So it's some deformation. Basically, it's the same algebra, but you replace the brackets with slightly modified brackets. Okay? And so it's no longer the classical SL2, but SL2 with a few Q's thrown in, so that's the Q. Okay? And at the moment, it's completely irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant for what I'm going to say in the next few minutes. And it will be said by others to some extent. So, okay. Now I have to, for the first time, erase something. Okay. Am I, please criticize me. You know, am I too slow? Am I being stupidly slow? Somebody should complain. If you will not complain, I will assume that I'm perfect, and then I will have to ask you to, whatever. Okay, so this is the this is UQG, but it comes with a portfolio of operations. Namely, there is a co-product. So, or you know what, let's start with a product. So, there is a product which goes from UQG, tensor UQG, into UQG. So there is a multiplication operation going this way. Okay? My preferred notation, so, you know, what is the tensor product of two things, right? So this will be words in the letters of G. This will be another set of words in the letters of G. So basically, an element in this tensor product is a pair of words written in the same language. Okay? But alternatively, you could just, instead of writing draw tensor Vladimir, okay, you could write a single word, D1, R1, O1, R1, V2, L2, A2, D2. So you can write a single word in an alphabet of double the size. So instead of just the English alphabet, you use the English alphabet with subscripts 1, which means this letter belongs to the first word, and with subscript 2, these letters belong to the second word. And then you just need to impose that any letter in the alphabet 1 commutes with any letter in the absolute 2, alphabet 2. Maybe I should use alpha and beta to say that these are any letters. Okay? So basically, you can shuffle the words as you please. You can shuffle the letters as you please, so long as you shuffle sort of letters that really belong to the same word, to different words. However, if you want to commute the L of blood, the L2 with the A2, you have to pay the price, depending on the algebra you run. So said differently, what I really try to tell you is that a different way of writing this is the universal enveloping algebra of two copies of the Lie algebra. So G1 direct sum G2. So instead of a single basis, now you have two bases, one with labels 1 and one with labels 2. Okay? Okay. There is also a coproduct going from here to here, and it's called delta. And if you look at it, it turns out that these two m's and this m and delta satisfy the exact same relation that the m and delta here satisfy. So by the way, what's an example of a relation that the M and delta here satisfy? So you know, if you have two strands, you can, on the one hand, stitch them and get a longer strand, and then double this longer strand, and you'll get sort of two copies of a long strand, or you can double each one independently, separately, and then do two stitches. So you can either stitch and then delta, or you can sort of do two deltas and then two stitches, and you get the same thing. And this is clearly true, not theoretically. And then the operations in quantized and universal enveloping algebra satisfy the same axiom. Okay. Maybe I want to say something stronger. You know, if I made the alphabet a bit bigger by allowing subscript, which really say which tensor factor you belong to, I may as well make it even bigger. So let me put here a subscript I. This means the Lie algebra or the Lie algebra G lying on tensor factor number I. And here, let me put J and K. And then it's fair to name the stitching operation, the stitching of components J and K into component I, and the coproduct operation, of component I into components J and K, and then it's exactly the parallel of the operations I had over there. Okay, but then there are more operations on universal enveloping algebras. There are the antipodes, Si, and then there are unary operations. So what's a unary operation? Well, it's operation whose domain is U of no copies of the universal enveloping algebras, basically the universal enveloping algebra of the empty alphabet. The universal enveloping algebra of the empty alphabet has a single word in it. The word is the empty word, that's the only word you can make. So it's just Q. So over here there is Q. Sorry. Q. No. It's Q. And out of Q, there are operations into here and also into here. And this operation is called C, the quark, and this operation is called R, the Young-Baxter element. And they too satisfy the same relations that the similar things here satisfy. So basically, a quantum group, or a quantized universal enveloping algebra, is precisely an algebraic version of the structure that appears in the not-theoretic portfolio. Okay? Let me delete R. I mean, R is perhaps the most important, but I'm still deleting it because I need the space below. Okay? What? Yes.
So, if it's like the hot algebra, is there a unit and a co-unit?
Yeah. I'm skipping the unit and the co-unit, and I also skip the unit and the co-unit here.
Okay.
The unit is insert a strand that doesn't interact with anything, and the co-unit is delete a strand. Okay, you can always take a big tangle and make it smaller by removing one of the strands. That's the co-unit. Okay? Now, okay, but you see, as I told you, these spaces are isomorphic as vector spaces to algebras of polynomials. So there is a symmetric algebra here, which is isomorphic to this one. It's the symmetric algebra. I think now I want to use a new letter, the letter B. B stands for a basis of G. Okay? So basically, G is all linear combinations of X, Y, and Z, and B will be just the letters X, Y, and Z. So this is the algebra of polynomials in, you know, X1, Y1, and T1, depending what the Lie algebra is, the basis elements. And this algebra is isomorphic, sorry, this algebra is isomorphic to this one as a vector space, not as an algebra. Likewise, here you can put the algebra of polynomials in two sets of, in two copies of the basis. So Bj union Bk, and I'll just write comma instead of union. And again, this is isomorphic to that. And since these are isomorphisms, you get M operations going that way, and delta operations going that way, and an S operation, which I will not copy because I want this space for something else. And likewise, there is Q, sorry, there is C, and there is R. Okay? But now these things are polynomials, or to be honest, especially, I mean, for the algebras themselves, it's enough to look at polynomials, but actually if you want C and R to exist, you need to look at to complete. You need to allow infinite power series. You need to allow words instead of finite sums of words, you need to allow infinite sums of words. So really, these are not polynomials, but power series. Yes?
Are they commutative polynomials?
They are commutative polynomials, but the operations are not the ordinary multiplication. The operations are the operations that you inherit from a non-commutative setting. So this non-commutative algebra is isomorphic as a vector space to a commutative algebra. Okay? But this means that you can copy the product from here to here, and then it will be a, not a standard product. Yes?
But if there are letters with subscript j and subscript k, they commute as usual.
Letters with different subscripts commute.
Okay.
Because they really live on different... It's just a way of saying things that live on different tensor factors.
Mm-hmm.
They happen in different universes. Sorry, this is so vague, yeah?
Q is the underlying field?
A Q is the underlying field, yes. It doesn't have to be Q. I write Q because I have no imagination. Okay? Okay. Now, there is actually, at the lower level, there is yet another type of operations. Namely, so you see, I told you that polynomials are isomorphic to elements in the freely in the universal enveloping algebra. But for this, we have to choose an ordering of the basis. We have to say, before I said, put all the y's and then all the x's and then all the t's. So really, there is a map from here to here, and let's call it O, so order, in some order, x, y, I don't know, then maybe you need to specify the rest of the basis. Okay? So, what does it mean? It means here you have a commutative polynomial in x and y and maybe some more variables. The map O turns such a commutative polynomial into a non-commutative polynomial by putting all the x's first and all the y's later and then all the rest in some prescribed order. Okay? But you know, there isn't a unique such OXY. There is another one, for example, O, Y, X, and then all the rest. Okay? So, you know, if you do O, X, Y of X cubed, X squared, Y cubed, the result is X squared, Y cubed. You put all the X's before all the Y's. But if you apply O, X, Y to X squared, sorry, O, Y x to x squared y cubed, the result is y cubed x squared. Because the rule is to put, here the rule is to put the y's before the x's. Okay? Now, in the domain space, we're in the symmetric algebra, so the order doesn't matter, but in the target space of the OXY, of the O operation, we're in a universal enveloping algebra and the ordering does matter. So these are distinct maps. But and each of them is an isomorphism. Both of them are isomorphisms as linear as vector spaces. Okay? So there is also an automorphism here which intertwines the two. Namely, there is a map from here from this space to itself, and this map is the map which makes a commutative diagram. So it's the map, so basically it's the composition of doing OXY followed by OYX inverse. Okay? So let's call it the swap operation of X and Y. It's the operation that tells you how to swap if things are given in are originally presented in the X before Y order, how to rewrite them so that they will work in the Y before X order. Okay, basically that's this composition. Okay. Yes?
So, you said that in the polynomial algebra, we should think of them as infinite polynomials, like power series.
Yeah, so everything is completed, yes. Everything is really not polynomials, but power series.
But was this already the case in UQ of G?
In UQ of G, you also need... So, UQ of G... the elements C and R are actually not in UQ of G. They are in the completion of UQ of G. Sorry, I have to complete here too.
Well, to get the isomorphism.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So the moral is that I have to understand these things. Okay? And I think I want to tell you a little bit more about them so that you'll appreciate what I mean by understanding them. Okay? So let me go back to this blackboard. Okay. So really I have a category and the category is the let me call the category DO. Okay? And in a minute you'll see why. Okay? And the category, this category has objects and morphisms. So the objects are, what parameterize the things that can appear here. Now, an algebra of polynomials is determined by the set of variables, which is just a finite set. Okay? So the objects are finite sets. Okay? And I have to tell you what are the morphisms between B and B prime. So a morphism between B and B prime is simply one of these maps that could occur here. Okay? So, basically a map from one set of polynomials to another set of polynomials. So, basically it's the set of linear homomorphisms between the symmetric algebra on B and the symmetric algebra on B prime. Okay? But you know, homomorphisms on from one vector space to another is just the dual of this vector space tensor that one. So this is symmetric algebra on B, dual, tensor symmetric algebra on B prime. Okay? But the dual of a symmetric algebra is just the symmetric algebra on the dual. Okay? So, this is equally well the symmetric algebra on B dual tensor the symmetric algebra on B prime. And what do I mean by B dual? I mean that I've chosen in advance a bijection. Sorry, this is going to be a bit informal. I'm choosing in advance a bijection between the Latin alphabet and the Greek alphabet. And so therefore, if you're asking what's the dual of X, the answer is given. The answer is it's Xi. Okay? And if you want to know what is the dual of Xi, the answer is given in advance, it's X. And likewise, the dual of Y is always denoted by eta, the dual of T is always denoted by tau, the dual of, you can guess, right? We all know the bijection, more or less, okay? And I'll never run out of letters, so it's fine. So I'm being informal, but really what I mean is that, you know, if I wanted to tell you, okay.
Sorry, what is the dual of S?
Phi. And yes, you can challenge me, but it's not going to occur, it doesn't matter. Okay? So, also the true dual of Y is not eta, but upsilon or something? No. Yeah, upsilon, but nobody knows how to write an upsilon. So therefore it's eta. So, and the dual of eta should be H, but, well, okay. But what do I really mean by that? Okay? So, by the way, I should say, this is the symmetric algebra, equally well, this is the symmetric algebra on an alphabet which consists of both B star and B prime. Okay? And now I can give it a meaning. Okay? So, or give you examples. So, for example, so really I'm telling you that I have a notation for maps between polynomial algebras. Okay? So, for example, let's consider the polynomial x, y, alpha cubed, beta. So this is a polynomial inside the symmetric algebra on the letters, so the Greek letters, so the dual letters are alpha and beta, so alpha, beta, and the Latin letters are x and y. So this is really a homomorphism from the symmetric algebra generated by A and B to the symmetric algebra generated by X and Y. And what does this homomorphism do? Well, it's the homomorphism which takes the dual of alpha cubed beta into XY. So it's the homomorphism. Oh, but what is the dual of alpha cubed beta? So I have to tell you how to pair things. So the dual, so I have to tell you how to pair an alpha cubed with an A cubed. What's the duality? So, okay, I mean, the duality of alpha with A, by definition, they're dual, So it's 1. The pairing of alpha with x, well, alpha is the dual of n, not of x. So by definition, this is 0. Okay? But what's the pairing of alpha cubed with a cubed? Well, I should have told you how symmetric powers are dual to each other. So basically, if you want to pair a symmetric thing with another symmetric thing, you sum over all ways of permuting one of them and pairing it in order with the other. So basically, this is alpha, 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 and you're asking how do you pair it with an AAA? The answer is you pair the alpha with the A, this alpha with this A, and this alpha with this A, but with allowing for all permutations. So the answer is 6 factorial. No, 3 factorial, which is 6. Sorry. Okay?
So this question, actually, I was wondering about this, when you define the O map.
No, O map, in the O map there are no coefficients. You take a polynomial to itself, but written in a specific order. Okay?
Then you put no coefficients.
Yeah, but when I pair elements of the symmetric algebra, I pair using all possible permutations. So, by the way, what is the pairing of alpha cubed with a squared y? So, this is like all ways of pairing an alpha, alpha, alpha with an AAY. So, alpha with A gives 1. This alpha with this A gives 1. This alpha with this Y gives 0. And this will be true for all permutations, so the answer is 0. Okay? So, in other words, what is XY alpha cubed beta doing? Well, as a map between polynomials, it's the map which maps the polynomial a cubed b to, so you pair the alphas with the a's and you read the output as the coefficient. So basically it maps a cubed b to y and it maps all other polynomials to 0. Sorry, all other monomials to 0.
But what about the
I forgot the 6. Yeah. Sorry, I forgot the 6.
6 or 1 over 6?
6. Because you're pairing z's with z's, and there are 3 factorial ways of pairing the alphas with the a's. Let me write it in a different way. Okay? So, I'm still in the category A. No, D-O. So, here's a different way of saying it. What was the polynomial? XY alpha cubed beta? God, I can't read. Yes. How does this act on an arbitrary function f? Okay? The answer is, it acts like xy, and then you replace the alpha with differentiation with respect to a, you replace the beta with differentiation with respect to b, so partial derivative with respect to a cubed, partial derivative with respect to b to the power 1, all of this acting on f, and after you do that, you substitute A is equal to B is equal to 0. That's exactly what I did. That's exactly what the symmetric algebra does. The pairing. So basically, you know, the third derivative with respect to A acting on A cubed will give 6. Acting on any lower power of A will give 0. Acting on any higher power of A will give some leftover A's, which will be killed by the fact that I set A is equal to B is equal to 0 at the end. Okay? And in general, if you want to know how does G of some Latin letters, So when I have lots of Latin letters, when I write Z, I mean a collection of Latin letters. So how does G of Z and Zeta, these are the duals of those, of course, act on a function F, a polynomial F? The answer is, it acts by, you just compute, you just take G and turn it into a differential operator by replacing zeta by d to d zeta, and then you apply this differential operator to the function f, and then you substitute z is equal to zero. Okay? So, hence the name. This is the category of differential operators with polynomial coefficients. Okay?
Well, the z you substitute to zero is only the z appearing in the zeta, right?
Yeah, it's only this z, the z due to this zeta.
Okay.
But I could have, you know, really I should have had here i's and j's and...
Yeah, okay.
Okay? I've switched from being abstract in the beginning to being overly concrete, and the reason is because we really need to understand this. Yes?
Do you accept a morphism from a set of letters to another set of letters which have some common letters?
Yes.
So really here you meant that among the zetas there could be some duals of the z's on the left.
Oh. Yeah, I suppose yeah, no, so I suppose for this to make sense the levels should be distinct.
Or should you
or you should temporarily rename and in fact that's what the programs do. You should temporarily rename. So basically, this is the z here is sorry, zz this z. So you know what? Let's call it z prime. So the z prime here is a dummy variable. Okay, it appears only for the duration of this computation. So you can temporarily give it a different name so that it doesn't interact with the z's in the coefficients. And yeah, you're right, and I apologize.
This is not quite right, because f, you know, you just write f, but you really mean f of z.
Yeah.
So then you should also write f of z prime.
Yeah. This is, you're right, it's f of z prime. So I have to change the in order to avoid variable conflicts, I have to do this rename. I apologize. Okay. So... here's a bunch of fun exercises. Okay, first of all, you know, I wanted power series, not polynomials. So likewise, I need to complete differential operators. And I need to learn how to compose potentially infinite order differential operators, how to apply them to things, and how to compose them with each other. Okay? So let me give you a few examples of the kind of operators that actually occur in reality. The kind of objects here that actually occur in reality. Okay? So let's start with some silly examples. So what is the identity which is a map from the symmetric algebra on a single variable z into the symmetric algebra on a single variable z. So this is a map. It's a member of our category. So there better be some infinite order differential operator that represents it. Okay? So I will call it the tensorial representation of the identity. And the tensorial representation of the identity, anybody is willing to guess without looking at the handout? And without being Roland?
What? Exponential of
Z, well, exponential of Z zeta.
Yeah.
Okay? So this is E to the Z zeta. Okay? Right? Because how does E to the Z zeta act on a function? So E to the Z zeta acting on a function f of Z is E or sum of z to the n dz to the n over n factorial acting on s, substituting z equal to 0, only the second z. And so really, I should say, maybe the right way to do it is the substitution is happening here. There is parentheses here. And then this is a coefficient. Okay? So if you if f is a x to z to the n, differentiating n times will give n factorial. And then dividing by n factorial, multiplying by z to the n, you came back to where you were. And if f is z to the any other power of z, then it will cancel somehow. By reasons I've already explained. Okay, how about the identity going from the symmetric algebra on Z1 up to Zk into itself? Well, so the tensor representing it is E to the sum zeta I zi. Okay? And we're beginning to see that the category that I really care about is the category of GDO, which stands for Gaussian differential operators, where Gaussian means an exponential of a quadratic. This is quadratic in the variables at hand. And you will see that almost everything we do stays within this category. And really, I need to tell you later, I will have to tell you how to compose arbitrary Gaussians. Okay? And so far it's easy, but it stopped being easy after a while. Okay? And it becomes the key point, or one of the key points. Okay? So next, archetypal product. So you see, I mentioned that. So first of all, it's a map from S of. Well, again, let me remind you what is the logic. I'm thinking of two tensor factors, so S of Zi tensor S of Zj, right? And I'm mapping it into a single tensor factor by multiplying, by the map, so this is a map into S of Zk. And the map is called MIJK. Now, the true MIJK that I care about is the one that the symmetric algebra inherits from the universal enveloping algebra. But at least, and I told you this is not the usual product, but at least at the highest level, so if you ignore or you know, if the algebra happens to be commutative, somehow if the or if the brackets are somehow smaller than the are somehow small, okay, then at top level this will simply be the ordinary product of polynomials. Okay. So at least so the archetypal product is the symmetric product. What's the symmetric product? Well, it's really the map which maps the symmetric algebra on Zi and Zj into the symmetric algebra on Zk. It's the map called Mijk, and basically all it does is to, well, it's to think of this as a tensor product and then combine the two words and forget the distinction between the two possible labels, between the two tensor factors. So really, it's just the map which maps Zi to Zk and Zj to Zk. So if I wanted to write it as a tensor inside the corresponding space of differential infinite order differential operators, so inside S of, so the two inputs are Zi and Zj, so they become Zeta I and Zeta J, and the output is still Zk. So what would it be? Francois, you already know, right? What is it?
Bracket Zi is J, Zeta I is J in the algebraic dimension.
Bracket? No, bracket, we're in the commutative one.
Sorry.
We're in the commutative context.
You want to just go in the commutative product?
Yeah.
Okay.
Somebody else, you know, you can. Poor Francois. Okay, this is just E to the zeta 1 plus zeta 2 times zk.
So zeta I.
Zeta I and zeta j. So you're welcome to check it. Okay? Likewise, what's the archetypal coproduct? The archetypal coproduct, delta I j k, is the thing defined on polynomial by it acts on z I and maps it into z j plus z k. Right? That's the sort of simplest coproduct in the world. So the corresponding tensor to it will be E to the zeta I times Zj plus Zk. So we're seeing more and more sophisticated quadratics in the numerator, in the exponent, and we will see a little bit more. Okay? So here is a tiny claim that makes figuring out what the tensorial element is very, very easy. So, claim, if phi is an arbitrary map going from the symmetric algebra on a basis B into the symmetric algebra on a basis B prime, then the tensorial representation of phi, so this should be an element of the symmetric algebra on B star union B. Okay? So what it is the following. First of all, you look at the exponential of basically the identity element in B. So summation over all B inside the basis, the domain basis of the dual to that B times B itself. Now you apply to it the map phi. What does it mean? It means that you compute the exponential, you really get a power series with many B's in it, and then you apply to it the map phi. So you get B primes instead of the B. Of the B, sorry, so this should be B prime. So you're in the right place. So for example, what is the tensor corresponding to the coproduct? This one, the one I didn't compute yet. So how do I compute it? I simply compute the coproduct of e to the zeta zi. Zeta I zi. Right? That's what the formula says. I mean the case where there is just a single variable. Okay? But the coproduct, well, okay, the coproduct in a polynomial algebra commutes with the product. So this is e to the delta zeta I zi. Zeta I is just a coefficient from the perspective of the coproduct. So this is e to the zeta I delta of zi, and this is e to the zeta I zi plus, sorry, zj plus zk as promised. And you can prove this claim on your own. It's really, really easy. There is really nothing there. You just check. Okay? But this allows to do some harder computation. So, how much time do I have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Well, okay, I'm obviously not going to get to very far, but let me do one computation, that one of the key computations. So, maybe before telling you about, before doing the computations, I'll remind you of a hint. I'll give you a hint. So there is something called the Weyl form of the canonical commutation relation. So if you took quantum mechanics, then you know that quantum mechanics is all about the canonical commutation, the Heisenberg algebra. And in the Heisenberg algebra, x bracket y, I already wrote it, is equal to t. Actually, you know, physicists write it p bracket q is equal to h. But I'll write it x bracket y is equal to t. And t commutes with everything else. So t commutes with everything is equal to 0. Okay, so this is the very, very famous algebra. And the Weyl form of the canonical...
This is commutator, right?
This
xy
is,
minus yx.
Yeah, this is xy minus yx. This is Heisenberg relations. But the Weyl form is how do exponentials commute. The Weyl form says that e to the psi x times e to the eta y is equal to e to the eta y e to the psi x, but unfortunately there is some correction factor, and the correction factor is a scalar. It's e to the minus psi eta t. So Google vial form of the CCR and you'll find that this is that it's there. This is a very, very standard thing in quantum mechanics. And it's also very, very easy to prove. Not that I know how, but I mean, yeah, it's very, I know how. Okay? Okay?
Maybe you can just in order to understand what it means, you could try to prove it. I mean, is this now in your language? Is this supposed to be?
No. This is background.
So this is
unrelated to anything that I said today.
So
yet.
Psi is a scalar.
Psi is a scalar. Eta is a scalar. They're not different. They're just numbers. Okay.
But I mean, it's probably not a coincidence that it's the same psi.
No, it's not a coincidence. I've chosen the notation to match. But this is a fact from day one class in quantum mechanics. Maybe not day one, but I mean, it's a standard. Okay. You want proofs? I'll give
you
a proof.
No, I want to say what the meaning is. And proof might have helped, but I guess now I'm. So you're just saying this is true?
In the universal envelope.
Eta being just numbers.
Yeah, you should think of them as small numbers. So that convergence perhaps will. You know, let me give you an example why it's true. Okay? It's formally true as power series. But let me prove it.
Oh, this is true in the universal algebra of this V algebra. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Completed.
In the completed universal enveloping algebra. Alternatively, in the group. It's true in the group form of the Heisenberg algebra. So you can prove it, for example, by finding representations. But here's an example of a representation. So the standard representation of the canonical commutation relations is this one is differentiation with respect to some variable, and this one is multiplication by that variable. So and this is a multiplication, right? This is the standard representation of quantum mechanics. So the exponential of differentiation is shift. That's Taylor's theorem, right? The exponential of differentiation is shift. The exponential of multiplication by y is multiplication by the exponential, so multiplication by a character. Okay? So the claim is that if you shift and then multiply by an exponential, it's the same as multiplying by the exponential and then shifting, except you have to shift also the exponent. And that's this factor. Okay? There are simpler proofs, but okay. There are other proofs, but anyway. So let's now turn it into something that I care about. So okay. I have the universal enveloping algebra of x, y, and t, where x, y, and t are satisfying these canonical commutation relations. I have the symmetric algebra of x, y, and t, and there are at least two maps going, in fact, exactly two maps going from here to here. Okay? There is the ordering map, where you put the x's before the y's, and there is the ordering map where you put the y's before the x's, and you can complain that I failed to specify where to put the t's, but it doesn't matter, the t's commute, so I mean I could specify it any way I want. Okay? Now, between these two, there is a comparison map. There is the switch XY map. Okay? So now I want to tell you what is the tensor representing switch XY. Okay, what is the Well, basically these lovely constructions that I made before for the swap of x and y. Okay? So the answer is, well, I had a lemma which I removed, but basically I have to compute swap x, y of e to the psi x plus eta y plus tau t. So I have to take the identity here and apply to it the operator. Okay? Now, what is this? This is O y x inverse of taking this exponential and ordering it in the order x, y. Well, if I order it in the x's before y order, I get e to the psi x, e to the eta y, e to the tau t. The tau t could be, you could put it anywhere you want. Okay? That's just, right? That's what I got. But now, this is happening here. And in here, I have the bare form of the canonical commutation relation. So I can replace the thing inside the parentheses by e to the eta y, e to the psi x, whatever it says there. So this is order yx inverse of e to the eta y, e to the psi x, e to the tau t minus psi eta t. Minus psi eta t. Okay? But now I have to undo the OIX operator. But luckily, the thing written here is written in YX order. So undoing the operator just means removing removing it. So this is, can you see down here? This is just e to the eta y plus psi x plus tau t minus psi eta t. Okay? And why did I bother to show you this? Because, you see, I'm looking at models for all the operations I will really need. These are like baby cases of the hard thing I will really need. And so far, all the baby cases gave me Gaussians. This is once again a Gaussian. It's a Gaussian if you think of, well, it's Gaussian in a funny way. Okay? If you split the variables to two pairs of variables, the eta y and the t tau, so it's Gaussian with respect to it's Gaussian with respect to eta y psi and, sorry, basically it's Gaussian if you regard the t and the tau as parameters, or if you regard the eta and the x as parameters. I said it wrong. What do I want to say? This isn't quite a Gaussian because this is cubic, but you can regard it as a Gaussian in two different ways. One is by thinking of t and tau as parameters and of the psi eta yx as variables, and then it's a Gaussian in psi eta yx. Or if you think of eta and y and psi and x as parameters and t and tau as variables, and then it's a Gaussian in tau and t.
Could you just for fun spell out what this now does?
What this what?
What this does. What is swap xy of the,
Swap xy
s to the
is
n, y to the m, t to the k.
It first writes them in xy orders, then rewrites them in yx orders, and it tells you how to rewrite them in yx
order. So I just want to spell out the answer, see whether this works. This is probably an exercise, but I suggest you do this exercise right now.
Okay. So, doing high powers will be hard. But let me just tell you what swap xy of xy is. Right? It's the thing which when written...
We understand the definition. The question is we should just apply this. Apply this thing to x to the n, y to the n.
Oh, I see. I see.
See what we get.
Okay. So, it's a huge differential operator. It's going to be a mess. So let's apply the differential operator e to the y dy. I'm replacing eta by dy plus x d psi
x dx,
sorry, plus t dt minus t dx dy. Do I have it right? Yeah. So let's apply this differential operator to some fixed polynomial x and y. And then substitute y is equal to 0. Okay? What are you going to get? So, basically, either the y differentiation from here eats this y, and then it comes with a y coefficient, and the x differentiation from here eats the x, and it comes with an x coefficient. So you get yx. This is from these two acting on the xy.
Why do you get it only once?
Because how else can you get it? The differentiation from here can act on the y. There's only one y.
Yeah, so you get twice. The first, the y dy gives you xy, and the x dx also gives you xy.
No. Because I need to, at the end I need to substitute xy equal to 0. Maybe I should, so the temporary variables here are the x bar, are the differentiation variables. Okay? So, at the end I need to substitute x bar, y bar equal to 0. So the only way to get a contribution is if you keep both x bar and y bar. When you expand this exponential, you'll get one of the terms will include a y dy bar plus times x dx bar.
He's right. Actually, there are two such derivations coming from the square. In the development of the expansion.
No, because there is also 1 over 2 in e to the x.
Exactly, so. Yeah. Because of that, you get what you say, but.
Yeah.
But he's right, there are 2, and then you divide by 2.
Well.
Isn't there also a minus t?
Yeah, and then there is one last term coming from here. So this part can act directly on this, and then you get the minus t. And this indeed is the canonical commutation relation. So, by the way, this sort of means that this one single function that appears here contains in it all information about the Heisenberg algebra. And I can similarly write a similar function for SL2. Okay? I think we're out of time. Are we?
Yeah.
So I'll say just two more words and then we should decide how to continue. Sort of here I got confused about how we say Gaussian, but so far we've seen terms like a dual variable times a variable and the product of two dual variables, and you'll have to believe me that when you look at the R matrix, you'll also find terms of the form X times Y. So really you get a general Gaussian. Okay? And then I will have to tell you that how to compose general Gaussians. So basically, we have this category of... So how to compose Gaussians in this sense. And the result will always be, again, a Gaussian, or in fact, I will need perturbed Gaussians. So the answer will always be a perturbed Gaussian, but it's a bit... There's something to learn how to do it. It's non-trivial. Okay? And then I will have to tell you that for the algebras we care about, and I didn't yet even tell you what these are, those structural functions are always perturbed Gaussians. So basically the technique that I'm creating is enough to completely implement the entire collection of operations and elements that you need for to compute all knot invariants. That's what I would have told you if I had an infinite amount of time. Okay, I'll stop for now. And I'm sorry if this is messy. Okay. Thank you. So, yeah. Questions or are we done?
No questions.
I have a quick question.
So
in the final formula, the psi and the eta seem to be the wrong way around. Don't you have to order them
here?
Or does the ordering
of dual variables work? Oh, but we're in an abelian universe now. We are in. We applied swap of x and y. And it's a map from a symmetric polynomial to symmetric polynomial, so the order doesn't matter.
But in the last step, you said that that was already ordered correctly, so you can just remove the OYX inverse.
Here?
Yes.
Oh, but the elements of the algebra are X and Y. Eta and Xi are just coefficients. They're numbers.
Okay.
So, in the Weyl relations, they're just numbers. So again, the order doesn't matter.
So, just to clarify, when it's in the symmetric one, you can write exponential of the plus, but on the universal one, rather write the product of exponentials.
Yes.
Okay.
So, in the symmetric one, this is, you know, you can rewrite it as the product of exponentials, which becomes the corresponding product of exponentials once you order, but now the order matters. Yeah.
So if I wanted to compute the swap map for x squared y,
then I would put here
I would have to find
x bar squared y.
I would have to find the term in d y bar and then dx bar squared.
Yes.
And would need to find what is the coefficient of this monomial in this big exponential. That would be my answer, right?
Yes.
That's what's actually going to be.
Yes.
So the, to the t by the t times dt never plays a role at all. It could be removed. Doesn't do anything to monomials in x bar and y.
The t by dt is basically the copying operation.
Yeah, yeah.
It copies whatever t is you have in the input to the output.
Yeah.
I mean, not t by dt. X of t by dt is really the copying operation.
Right, so actually you could also say this is just the identity and then times e to the minus t x bar dy bar, and so
yeah.
That probably means there is a quick way to say what is the swap operation on anything.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, there is also, you know, what is it called? The weak formula, weak pairings, things like that. And this is a form of that. So, you know, if you want to know how to swap x, 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 y, 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 so you want to rewrite it in the correct order. So you basically have to slide this y to here. Then you have to slide that y to here. Then you have to slide that y to here. Each y can either slide happily, or you have to compute the commutator against one of the things. Every time you compute the commutator, you get a t factor, and then the t can slide out. Okay. So basically, you have to count how many ways are there to pair the x's and the y's, and then those things that are paired disappear and get replaced by a t, and that amounts to the same computation as this. But I guess, why am I telling you this? I mean, there is a lot to say about computation in the Heisenberg algebra, but I'm leading in a different direction. Yeah.
This thing you described, this is the weak ordering. This is the weak ordering.
The weak ordering. Yeah, I used to know these things and I forgot. These are standard quantum mechanics calculations, but again, yeah. So again, what remains is to learn how to compose such things. And then to find the algebras for which it is a matter. Okay. So, thanks again.